Next is a matter of Brian Ambrose. Counsel, could please step forward. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Nathaniel Levy, Deputy Attorney General, on behalf of the Department of Corrections.
With us for the ACL, American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey Foundation as amicus representing the Max Compound Advisory Unit, the Incarcerated Persons Liaison Committee, and the Ed McMahon Board of Trustees.
KW McCann, Rhonda McLoughlin, 69 Grove Street, Somerville, New Jersey, on behalf of Mr. Ambrose.
Afternoon, Timothy Malone, Ashley Kine, Walter Hayden, on behalf of respondent, New Jersey Civil Liberties Union.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Levy, please go ahead.
Please reserve a few minutes for rebuttal.
Yes.
May it please the court. DOC and the public as a whole count on corrections officers to keep incarcerated persons safe and to carry out their duties impartially, responsibly, and within the clear limits set by DOC policies. Brian Ambrose shattered that trust through his undisputed violations alone. DOC sensibly concluded that Mr. Ambrose could no longer work as an officer at Edna Mann, yet the CSC improperly downgraded his penalty to a 6-month suspension. This court should find that decision was unreasonable and should be reversed outright for 2 independent reasons. First, the CSC's decision to downgrade is unreasonable on its face. That is all this court would have to say to reverse the decision below. Second, the unreasonable nature of the CSC's decision is made worse by its failure to grapple with or give weight to DOC's expertise on prison safety and security. I'll begin with the first reason. Regardless of the weight owed to DOC, the CSC's decision did not and could not justify a suspension. Mr. Ambrose failed to report a kiss from an incarcerated woman in his custody, despite being trained to report any untoward interactions between officers and prisoners, especially of an intimate or sexual nature. That raises grave concerns for DOC about whether he can be trusted to properly protect those in his care, and whether he can be trusted to report other sexual acts involving himself or others at Edna Mann. And the failure to report that kiss followed other unduly familiar actions he took with the same woman, even passing a message from her to another prisoner and likewise failing to report it, is preferential treatment that can endanger her, undermine his authority, and jeopardize the institution as a whole. The CSC's only response was to express concerns about how the matter proceeded on a separate, ultimately unsustained charge relating to oral sex. But how the department proceeded there says nothing about what the penalty should be for the misconduct that was established. The CSC thus violated the Hornbook principle that agencies must base their decisions on a consideration of the relevant factors and not irrelevant ones. And the CSC did not cogently explain its mitigation decision because it could not do so. No reasonable justification exists to prevent DOC from removing an officer at Edna Mann after engaging in this misconduct. The second basis for reversal is also compelling. The CSC violated the admin law principle that expertise matters. The CSC correctly acknowledged that sometimes an offense can so threaten prison safety or security that it requires removal, despite the usual approach to progressive discipline. And so the question here really boils down to how seriously those offenses threaten prison order and safety. That's a question on which DOC's unique expertise shaped by decades in prison management. And yet the CSC failed to give DOC's expertise significant weight. There is no doubt that CSC reviews de novo and gets to make the final call. But when it does so, it has to at least grapple with, or more seriously account for, DOC's knowledge of the serious safety consequences that would follow from allowing Mr. Ambrose to return, especially in an unfamiliarity case like this one. That's how the longstanding regime established by Henry and Bowden works in practice. Before I conclude, I have one final observation. In light of both of those legal errors and the record evidence here, this court should reverse outright and allow DOC to ensure it can guarantee the safety of those at Edna Mann. But in the alternative, this court should at least remand to allow DOC to expand the record in the case relating to the oral sex charge, to present Mr. Ambrose's stipulation from his separate criminal proceeding as to the voluntariness of his recorded confession, and to cross-examine him about that. After all, an ALJ that understands that the confession was true, was voluntary, might be more likely to confine the confession was true. But this court only needs to reach the reopening question if it fails to reverse outright on the sustained conduct. So for any of those reasons, because the CSC decision downgrading the penalty for sustained conduct is unreasonable on its face, because the CSC failed to give DOC's expertise significant weight, and because the separate oral sex charge should be reopened, this court should reverse. I welcome the court's questions. And I think an appropriate place to begin is with what the CSC itself recognized in its decision, and the key place to look in the record is at PA 21. So the CSC recognized these acts of undue familiarity and failure to report and conduct unbecoming were clearly serious and highly concerning, and, quote, touch at the heart of safety and security, end quote, at Edna Mann. And it understood that the degree to which this misconduct compromised safety and security was the primary cue on the mitigation issue, because the commission also recognized that regardless of a public employee's disciplinary record, regardless of a DOC officer's disciplinary record, the seriousness of an offense occurring in the environment of a correctional facility may nevertheless warrant removal where it compromises safety and security of the institution or has the potential to compromise prison order and discipline. And the commission drew from this court's decision in Henry. It also cited Carter, another progressive discipline case where this court established the same principle, that some conduct that is so egregious can warrant removal despite the usual approach to progressive discipline. So in other words, the commission recognized that the egregious acts here had serious safety and security consequences, and that that is often both a necessary and a sufficient condition for removal. Nevertheless, the CSC then took a leap and said removal was not warranted, but it didn't give a cogent and reasonable explanation, or really, I would submit, any explanation at all. The one sentence explanation that it did offer flunks basic reasonableness review. Again, it referenced the way the matter proceeded on a totally unrelated oral sex charge. But the other side points to no authority for the proposition that the way that the fact that other charges were not proven has any bearing whatsoever on the penalty for charges that were proven. And we're not aware of any authority otherwise. The commission also references the fact that Mr. Ambrose should have an opportunity to a second chance to demonstrate his competence. But that point about competence really misses the mark, because again, the CSC had already recognized that there were dire safety and consequences here. As to the law here, it's Hornbook law that an agency decision has to show, and I'm quoting this court's decision in Howard Savings Institution or Howard Savings Bank, it has to, quote, show how and why the agency made up its mind, but based on the relevant factors. It's also Hornbook law that an agency cannot consider factors that it wasn't supposed to consider. So here we plainly have an absence of explanation, quote, this court's decision in Riverside General Hospital, in this record. Because the commission said, there were really bad acts here. They can warrant removal. Often they do warrant removal. And yet, we're going to give Mr. Ambrose a mulligan. But there was no adequate explanation. And as I mentioned,
let me turn to your second argument for a moment, your argument that there should be a remand for the consideration of the stipulation in the criminal case. The commission argues, well, that's not newly discovered evidence. That was on the docket for years, public docket. It's not something that was just unavailable to the DOC at the time of the proceedings before the ALJ. What's your response to that?
I'll certainly give you my response. Let me add briefly first that, again, this court only needs to reach that question if it decides that the remedy
Understood.
For the errors.
Understood.
Thank you, Your Honor. So, Justice Patterson, the response to that is that counsel below spoke with the Huntington County Prosecutor's Office who tried Mr. Ambrose in the criminal case. Counsel from that office represented to counsel below that they had given us all of the relevant files from that proceeding, and there's no reason for counsel below or counsel from this department to question the representation of another agency, another sister agency in the state government, that they'd given all the relevant files. Later on, after the ALJ's initial decision issued, someone from HCPO then said, oh, we forgot to provide this one document, which turned out to be quite irrelevant and quite an important document.
So you were plainly aware of the ongoing criminal proceedings in Huntington County, correct?
Your client was aware, yes, although those proceedings had ended, Your Honor, by the time of the...
And had the full record you've described? And that record would have shown the absence of a Miranda hearing, correct? Which is fairly common in virtually every criminal case. So is it wrong to infer that anybody looking at that file would reasonably conclude they didn't contest this? They walked away from an argument about voluntariness.
I would only add, Your Honor, that as to these questions about the department's diligence in scanning the docket or drawing the right inferences from the files that were provided from Huntington County, I would just say that a lack of diligence was not the reason the CSC itself provided for not reopening. And the CSC's decision here is what's under review. The CSC seemed to make the decision or seemed to say, I believe it's at PA 19 in a sentence or two, that the stipulation as to the voluntariness of the confession wasn't even legally relevant because the ALJ here made credibility findings. Lack of diligence was not something on which that rationale rested.
Why should you be permitted to reopen a proceeding if all the information were in plain sight and had not been argued in that proceeding?
So I still think the answer is yes, Your Honor. And I think it's important just to note that the standard here for reopening the administrative proceedings is more flexible than what you see with the standards for reopening discovery in criminal or civil litigation, and certainly more lenient than the standard for ordering a new trial based on after acquired or after discovered evidence in normal litigation. So I think this court's decision in a case like Matter of Callan, 92 NJ14, makes that precise point. Again, we only need to demonstrate good cause. And I think the relevance combined with the representation, the relevance of the stipulation combined with the representation of HCPO establishes good cause here.
Just to make sure, though, this is only an argument in the alternative. If we were to agree with you that the CSC acted arbitrary and capriciously in regards to reducing the penalty, we would not reach this at all.
Absolutely correct, Your Honor.
And then the attorneys for DOC in this matter are not criminal attorneys, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
So they themselves are not prosecutors, regardless of whether it's at a county or state level?
They are not prosecutors, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So I believe I mostly touched upon the first reason for reversal here. I'd like to just briefly add a word about the second, which is that the proper or significant weight wasn't given to DOC's expertise on prison safety and security in this matter. And let me very briefly just explain what that means. We're not asking for the recognition of a new standard. We're simply asking for the faithful application, if this court even needs to reach that issue, of Henry and Bowdoin itself. So I think those cases recognize that, again, as I mentioned, agencies have to base their decision on all the relevant factors. One of those factors here in DOC disciplinary proceedings is DOC's expertise on prison safety and security. And the CSC gets to review DOC de novo, but it just has to show that it really grapples with or gives significant weight to the views of DOC about the consequences of misconduct that did occur and the consequences that would flow from allowing the bad actor to return. And here we see some recognition of those safety consequences because CSC agrees with DOC, but then there's no grappling with DOC's view that allowing Mr. Ambrose to return would further compromise safety and security to a degree that is intolerable and to a degree that would compromise the work the department is trying to do at NMEA.
But both Bowden and Henry, if I'm not mistaken, reiterate that this is de novo review. They both seemed, read together, they both seem to require an acknowledgement by the reviewing agency that it that the DOC's policy of determinations are given significant weight because of the really unique mission of the DOC and the responsibilities of the DOC. Does it require, you don't read Henry and Bowden to require ruling in your favor, obviously. Does it require ultimately a different decision that would be made without that special consideration, as long as the agency is acknowledging the importance of the DOC's determination and the importance of the policies behind the DOC's determination with respect to a disciplinary matter? See what I'm saying?
There's a lot in there. Let me try to respond to everything, and please correct me if I'm missing part of the question, Your Honor. But
I could break it down if you wanted me to, but give it a try.
Sure. In short, the CSC certainly can reach a different conclusion than DOC. That's part of its statutory authority and mandate to exercise de novo review. It's just the grappling and the application of weight part, which is all that we're really pressing. So it can reach a different outcome, but it has to show some necessary links in the chain as to how it gets to that conclusion. And here we don't have those links in the chain. Again, this court need only reach this question of how to properly read and apply Henry and Bowden together if it decides not to simply reverse outright because the explanation below was arbitrary and capricious and could not be supported by the sustained conduct.
Let me ask you, though, we have the commission in its decision noting the importance of progressive discipline, noting that But on the other side of that coin, noting the importance or the fact that a single act in a correctional setting can have a profound impact on security of the facility. So it determined that 6 months was the correct level from its point of view. It does seem to have, my question to you is, doesn't it seem to have considered the policy considerations that apply to DOC and done what Henry told it had to do?
No, Your Honor. So the only explanation for the mitigation is certainly there's a recognition of the standard of the fact that cases like Henry, Carter, Herman all say that a one-time offense can be so egregious and so imperil safety of the public or of a certain sensitive population that person has to go. And yet it then says in a one sentence explanation, nevertheless, the way this entire matter proceeded basically means this, that this person can be trusted to return after 6 months. So there's no grappling or no weight.
What does Henry require by way of grappling? I mean, it seems that it requires, the commission can't leap over the fact that this is the DOC, this is not just any agency. And then it has very important and you know, grave responsibilities for the safety of inmates and staff. But if it does consider those issues and then rules against or comes to a different conclusion than the DOC, why has it failed to meet the Henry test?
So I think Henry itself is a perfect illustration, Your Honor. It was the CSC's predecessor, the Merit Systems Board. Decided to downgrade the penalty and impose only a suspension. The conduct, there were two officers whose conduct was at issue in the case, put aside Officer Torres, who fell asleep overlooking the mess hall, just focus instead on Officer Henry, who falsified a report about his findings of marijuana. He said he found them in the weightlifting shack, where instead, he found marijuana on a incarcerated person's bed, and he lied in good faith because he wasn't trying to protect the incarcerated person. He was actually just conducting his own investigation. But this court said that so imperiled safety and security that that person, that we're going to take fully into account DOC's view, the only way the court could have recognized that that good faith falsification of a report had such serious safety consequences was to really account for DOC's presentation of the view that those had serious safety consequences.
So it changed. So you're saying that in Henry, the consideration of DOC's point of view and all of the responsibilities that DOC have changed the result. Is that really what Henry requires as a standard? I mean, you're talking about grappling with it, but if there is a decision that reflects from the point of view of an appellate court that these considerations were part of the mix and they were to some extent accepted by the commission, but they were not entirely accepted by the commission, why is that a failure under Henry?
Well, we don't see any indication here of why they weren't accepted. I don't want to sound like a broken record, mm-hmm. Your Honor, but the one sentence explanation about how this entire matter proceeded on a separate charge does not show the commission's thinking about why it accepted the consequences of the misconduct, but nonetheless rejected DOC's view about why that wasn't so serious that he could return. So for instance, the CC might have said something about Mr. Ambrose's, you know, personal character, individual character, something about why he demonstrated in the course of the trial before the ALJ that he could once again be trusted. It might have made a point about how in carrying out its duty to ensure consistent discipline across the state workforce, you know, that this rises to the level comparable to other cases in which only suspension was awarded, but we don't see any of that here. All we see is really a non sequitur, one sentence explanation.
Actually, the appellate division, in rejecting the DOC's challenge to the progressive discipline, said the CSC further found, to your point, quote, given the way this entire matter proceeded, but then it continued, and acknowledging that the most serious misconduct was not proven, the CSC cannot find that Ambrose should be removed without a second opportunity to demonstrate his competence, and it also weighed his lack of a disciplinary record. So it was a little bit more than simply this one sentence, given the way this entire matter proceeded.
I had certainly focused on the words given this entire matter proceeded. I do think all of that is encompassed in the one sentence I was focusing on. And I think, Your Honor, the absence of explanation is really clear on its face in everything that you read. I don't think any of the other words after the clause that I had initially just focused on really helps the commission's case here.
But it seems like the explanation is that dismissal was determined based on a host of violations, including additional sexual offenses that were not proven or considered. And therefore, it concluded that the most serious charges not having been demonstrated, they found it nevertheless, and they did say that, serious violations that impacted security, but they said they increased the penalty from a 20-day suspension to a 6-month suspension. That's a pretty substantial increase. And after explaining why they didn't agree with the 20-day, but they thought it was serious and serious enough to warrant 6 months, if not termination, because the most serious charges weren't proven, how does that not carry out the responsibility?
So there are two parts to my answer, Your Honor. Okay. One is that the 6-month suspension, even increasing it from 20 days, which is truly would be unjustified here, but 6 months is also unjustified on this record. And secondarily and separately, it didn't carry out their duty to explain and grapple. But just thank you for asking the question, because I think the question gets at why was this conduct really so serious? And why is the only result warranted on the basis of the sustained conduct removal? And I'll tell you why. So there were two acts that were sustained here, part of an overall pattern of undue familiarity and failure to report by Mr. Ambrose. First, he relayed a message from J.O. from one incarcerated person to another. That is a flagrant violation of the undue familiarity policy. Any kind of demonstration of favoritism or preferential treatment from a law enforcement officer in a prison to an incarcerated person, it puts a target on the back of the incarcerated person. It likewise does the same for the officer, and things escalate as the Bowdoin court.
So is that in unto itself warrant? Does that in unto itself warrant termination? And failure to terminate means that CSC has to be reversed in every case.
So the department did press, even when it was arguing that the oral sex charge should be sustained, it was also arguing throughout the proceeding below that the violation of the undue familiarity policy alone and the related failure to report a kiss from a woman incarcerated and a man alone warranted removal. So that argument was made.
I understand it was made. CSC just didn't agree with you.
CSC did not agree.
And the ALJ didn't agree.
Correct. And again, CSC does, our position is not that CSC has to agree with DOC in every case, but in undue familiarity cases, which are really just a small fraction of DOC disciplinary cases, we do think that the misconduct is generally always sufficiently egregious to warrant removal. And the CSC agreed with DOC on that point. It agreed on egregiousness. It agreed on the safety consequences.
Can you tell us whether undue familiarity cases of this nature that you've just described, passing a note to another inmate, commonly result in removal?
I'm not aware of another case with an analogous fact pattern where there is both passing a message to another inmate and then a related act of intimacy that's not reported with that same inmate. But I think there are cases both resolved at the commission and at the appellate division level where undue familiarity is really strictly enforced. This court need not engage in any line drawing on undue familiarity in this case, because I think the precedents clearly established this falls well on one side of the line.
And that's because in Henry, for example, the incident that was found to warrant termination and to cause the CSC's decision to be arbitrary and capricious was falsifying where the person found marijuana, correct?
Falsifying where the person found marijuana and in good faith, not to protect anyone or to provide preferential treatment.
And what was the fact pattern in Bowdoin that led to the same conclusion that the person had to be removed rather than and reversing the CSC's decision?
In Bowdoin, a corrections officer had played cards with inmates and then brought cigarettes in to pay down gambling debts.
The ALJ specifically found that Ambrose did not commit the more serious offense. She made credibility findings. How do we factor those findings into this analysis?
I don't think the credibility findings as to the more serious charges factor at all into the primary issues before the court, which is whether the explanation to mitigate here was arbitrary and capricious. I think the answer is plainly yes. So this court need not reach any of the issues related to voluntariness and credibility and the related stipulation in the criminal case if it reverses the CSC on the initial.
So on your first point, we should treat this as if those allegations of the more serious sexual offense were never made. Credibility, we defer to the credibility findings. I know you'd prefer we not, but we defer to the credibility findings and you're not challenging those here except insofar as the stipulation may factor into it.
Correct, Your Honor. We are not challenging findings of fact on credibility made by the ALJ. I would only quibble with your question slightly about pretending that those findings were never made because...
The findings were never made, but we are looking only here as to the substantiated charge.
Correct. Reversal is warranted purely and solely on the basis of the very serious substantiated charges of undue familiarity and failure to report. They were also charged as conduct unbecoming, and this court's cases are legion, saying that various acts of conduct unbecoming by law enforcement officers can warrant removal, notwithstanding.
And further, you have his testimony at the hearing, setting aside the more serious charge, that the inmate kissed him and that he did not report, which supports the undue familiarity charge on its own. No?
Sorry, was Your Honor's question whether failure to report the kiss itself was an act of undue familiarity?
Yes.
Yes, I think the answer is...
And he's admitted to that, is what I'm saying. That was his testimony at the hearing.
Are you aware of any case in which an officer retained his position after an undue familiarity charge or the failure to report an intimate physical contact with an inmate charge were substantiated?
I'm not aware of any such case, Your Honor.
Thank you.
If the court has no further questions, I will see you on rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Levy. Ms. Huertas.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I believe my colleague, Mr. Levy, adequately addressed the legal issues before the court today. So I would just like to take a few minutes to provide context as to the impact of this case. And I believe my clients are truly in the best position to provide that context. As you know, I represent two groups of women currently incarcerated at the Edna Mann facility, as well as—
Can you keep your voice up a bit, please?
As well as the Board of Trustees. And that board is made up of people who this current governor appointed for the purpose of addressing the longstanding and well-documented history of violence and abuse, especially sexual abuse, we know to be occurring at the facility. This is all public record and very well known. And because of that, they want you all to know the profound concerns that they have about the possibility of Mr. Ambrose returning to the facility. And the Civil Service Commission simply fails to take into account any of this important context and doesn't even mention it. And from the brief, my clients really not only want to talk about that profound impact, but also, profound concern, but also this idea of accountability. Because that's frankly why they're in the facility, is because they are being held accountable for their actions. However, it seems as though there seems to be a different standard for corrections officers, at least from the decisions below. And, I won't go, I know the court has read the brief, and so I won't go through the story of everyone that we spoke to, every one of my clients, but I do want to take a moment to highlight something said by a woman we represent, who I refer to as Kristen C. And so she says that she finds the lower court's decision confusing because it seems to create this gray area between what is acceptable and what is unacceptable. And there is that gray area does not exist for the people incarcerated there. And so she feels as though the badge that corrections officers wear, I mean, they should be held to a higher standard of accountability and not a lower one. And there's good reason for that. We task our corrections officers with an immense amount of responsibility. They are oftentimes in charge of every aspect of incarcerated people's lives. They just, a lot of times incarcerated people can't go eat lunch. They can't go outside. They're often told when to wake up, when to go to sleep, sometimes even when they can go to the bathroom. They can't do that without the permission of corrections officers. And so they have this incredible power over incarcerated people and people in state custody. And because of that, we must make sure that their judgment is impeccable. And frankly, Mr. Ambrose has already demonstrated, at least in this instance, that he does not have the type of judgment that is compatible with what is needed in order to work in this environment. And like I said, that is extremely troubling when we're putting people with that kind of power with such vulnerable populations. And so I'm not weighing in on the unsubstantiated claims. I'm simply talking about what we do know here, what has been admitted by Mr. Ambrose, what is not in dispute by the decisions below. And that is that, Mr. Ambrose has already shown that he just engaged in a kiss with an incarcerated woman and then he chose not to report that kiss. And someone with that kind of judgment just cannot be working in this facility. It impacts, it not only undermines all of the important work that's happening in the Mann facility, it also creates a dangerous environment. And so, we're not asking the court to always have to independently investigate what's going on when taking into account disciplinary matters and disciplinary cases. But we are asking the court to not put on blinders when it comes to what we know is happening in the facilities, what is well documented, what is in the media, what we know is happening there. We have to take into account what the actual impact is. And so if there are no questions from the court, I will leave it there. I just want to say that we appreciate the opportunity to bring our clients' voice to this important case.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. McCann, excuse me.
Good afternoon. Can I please report? The system that Mr. Ambrose has gone through in terms of the administrative procedures is really, when you consider it, it's remarkable and it's wonderful. It's many layers of deferential review. In this particular case, however, it seems like the Department of Corrections, to use an analogy, wants to play the fourth quarter of this game over and over again until they get the score that they want. Many people have reviewed this, and unless this court can conclude that somebody was arbitrary, capricious, unreasonable, some deference is due to the commission, deference is due to the ALJ. There's no outlier here. There's no decision that's made. There's no fact that's found. There's no mistake of law that occurs that would sustain depriving Mr. Ambrose of his career as a corrections officer. The Department of Corrections talks a lot about, and the cases discuss, the safety, security of the facility, the safety of the inmates. And of course, this is paramount importance. But in its brief and today in the presentation, with all due respect, the DOC waves this formula around as if it's talismanic, as if it solves all the analysis of this particular case. But in their brief and here today, they don't point to any specific threat, any specific danger that resulted from this particular case, the behavior of Mr. Ambrose in this case, not a hypothetical. Well, in the brief, it says, now these two inmates know that Mr. Ambrose is the type of corrections officer who will violate the procedure on undue familiarity. Well, as the transcript of the ALJ hearing sets forth, there's a lot of ambiguity in that undue familiarity requirement. For example, my colleague, Mr. Ronco, asked one of the DOC officers who testified in front of the ALJ, well, is this interpreted, the undue familiarity doctrine, is this rule, is this interpreted with common sense? Is common sense really the rule here? And the DOC officer says, no, it's not common sense. It's following the rule. But you have to have, we're not talking about robots. We're not talking about automatons. The corrections officer has to use common sense with this undue familiarity. For example, the DOC representative says it's okay to talk about the weather.
Here, the undue familiarity charge was sustained, and you didn't file an appeal as to that, did you?
No, but I'm just saying, Your Honor, with all due respect, I think you have to go further in considering what happened in this particular case.
Didn't your client admit to engaging in the conduct that was in violation of the undue familiarity?
My point is,
argument that it was unclear that he was supposed to report this kiss and that it was unclear that he wasn't supposed to pass notes.
And we have no argument with that. Clearly, a kiss is reportable.
Set aside whether it's reportable. Is kissing an inmate or being kissed by an inmate a serious offense?
It is serious, Your Honor, but...
Is it a very serious...
I would say you have to look at the circumstances. The ALJ finds that this is a fleeting kiss. That's unexpected kiss. You know, there are kisses and then there are kisses.
Is this kind of contact generally between a corrections officer and an inmate something that can jeopardize safety of the inmate? Jeopardize safety of the institution?
Under certain circumstances, but that's not what occurred here. With all due respect, that's not what the ALJ.
So what happened here, in your view, was not a serious offense?
The fact that it was unreported is serious. It's not an offense that requires a termination of his career.
Was it this offense, the facts in this case, a serious offense in your judgment?
I would say certainly the kiss is a serious offense. Passing the communication, I don't believe was a serious offense.
Do we have any knowledge of what the message was?
Yes. The message is, I love you. The message is, I love you, and I'm mad at you. The message is not, pick up the heroin at the dock. The message is not, we're going to jump the guards. It's not a message that goes to the safety and security of the institution. It's something...
Do we know that? Do we know that that's precisely what that meant?
That's not what the Department of Corrections argued. They don't argue that there's anything nefarious behind this innocuous communication.
But they went so far as to try to sustain this charge because the very impact of passing a message from one inmate to another is a breach of the protocol.
There's no doubt that it's a breach. But I don't think my point is that I don't think the analysis stops there. You have to say, what is it about, because you have to judge the man. You have to judge the facts and circumstances. You know, there's a saying, as cold as a stepmother's kiss. Kisses are something that you often have to know the context in order to assess what it means, the seriousness of it.
But then the failure to report tacks on a whole other component to it, where we're talking about two separate zero tolerance infractions where the institution says, if this happens, we will not accept it. It is unacceptable for one of our employees to do this. What does the CSE do with that information?
It has to be evaluated. You can't, we're not putting facts into a machine, into a computer, and then getting the right feedback at the end. And like I said, a corrections officer, corrections officers are incarcerated, basically. I mean, they are, they return to a place where they're in jail every day.
They're choosing to work there, correct?
Yes.
So is it fair to say that they're incarcerated?
Well, they are in jail every day. My point is simply that it's a very difficult job, and maintaining order in a facility is a very difficult job. This is not Henry, where there's an affirmative lying, a deception on behalf of the officer. This is not...
There's an omission, right? There's an omission.
This is an omission, correct. If we want to put it within the context of, is it a misconduct, a malconduct, negligence? What it is that it is an offense. We don't doubt that. What we are saying is that the ALJ, the Civil Service Commission, the Appellate Division have all come to an understanding that this is the appropriate penalty. We're not saying he shouldn't be punished. We're saying that this is appropriate, it's reasonable, it's based upon the facts and circumstances of this particular case. Let's not, I submit that we shouldn't blow it up. You shouldn't say it's something worse than it is. It's a mistake.
How do you respond to your adversary's position concerning their expertise and the fact that this individual would have to go back to their employee where it's within their ranks and they're making a determination that that would disrupt the workplace and the environment? And
They haven't said how it would disrupt the workplace, how it would disrupt the environment. They haven't said it. They haven't evaluated a message of I love you. how that disturbs the institution. It's just the same language over and over again. It's a threat. It's a threat. It impacts the safety and security, but not how. In this particular case, you know, it's like that old saying, it's better for, you know, the feeling is it's better for one man to suffer than the nation perish, which we don't consider to be fair or just. You know, it's Mr. Ambrose's career. It's Mr. Ambrose's life. And it has to be balanced. And that's why we have this multifaceted system, which is very good, of deferential review.
Has there ever been another case in which an officer retained his position after undue familiarity or failure to report intimate physical contact with an inmate were substantiated by the CSC?
I'm not aware, ma'am.
And so I'm not asking both. I'm asking either or. So undue familiarity charge sustained, person keeps their job, or intimate physical failure to report intimate physical contact with an inmate sustained, person keeps their job.
Yeah, I frankly don't know, but we have very, very careful review. The ALJ was very thorough. The Civil Service Commission is certainly aware of the mandate. Henry also indicates, there's language in Henry that indicates that the Department of Corrections is not an exception here. They don't, the legislature does not give them any special privileges in assessing what the penalty is, any different from any other agency.
Well, there is a statute that gives the DOC broad discretionary power to fashion disciplinary policies pertaining to safety and security.
Surely, but the Henry Court does mention that the legislature has not exempted them from the review of any other, as if it were any other agency. That's the point.
But the court then also did reverse the CSC, finding that the officer's conduct in that case subverted the discipline at the prison and disrupted and destroyed order and discipline,
mm-hmm.
and that the CSC did not adequately consider that, correct?
That's correct. And like I said, you know, you're with the other matter, where the prison guard is gambling, you know, and there is a question of gambling debts. I mean, that is explosive. We can tell that. I mean, people.
But why is a prison guard failing to report intimate physical contact with a female inmate in a women's prison not extraordinarily concerning?
It is. And I think the commission does say it's extraordinarily, but it's. You have to go to what the ALJ finds about this. This is.
But the CSC disagreed with the ALJ. I hear you trying to go back to the ALJ a lot, but it seems like the CSC disagrees, and it specifically says it cannot fathom how any custodial staff in a correctional facility for women could reasonably interpret an unwanted kiss as anything but an unusual incident that needed to be reported.
Absolutely.
And then on the other one, it cannot imagine any circumstances where the relaying of a personal message between inmates by a senior correctional police officer would be appropriate. So the CSC doesn't really agree with the ALJ in saying that this was all not a big deal.
Exactly. And that's correct. But I keep referring to the ALJ because the ALJ was the finder of fact that heard Mr. Ambrose testify in person, that did not hear the Department of Corrections, J.O., their confidential informant. She was not brought in. They played a videotape for the ALJ. The ALJ had what the DOC presented before her and found that Mr. Ambrose was the credible witness in that particular case. And her finding is that it is an unexpected situation in that closet. It was an unexpected kiss. She describes it as a peck. So I'm just saying that in consideration of the punishment for something, failing to report something like that, there's an issue in an aspect of this that was dismissed, and that's the Mucinex. You know, the J.O. says, he brought Mucinex into the facility. And he explained that. He says, these prisoners are asking for things all the time. And that's to be expected within the confines. And these people that you see every day, they ask all the time. It's not an extraordinary situation.
Could the ALJ's credibility determination have been different had the ALJ known about the stipulation?
I think that with all due respect, Your Honor, I think the stipulation argument is of no moment. That's the best way I can put it. It's a tactical decision that Mr. Ronco made during the course of litigating the criminal case. It goes specifically by its face to the Miranda issue. And as the court is well aware, the finder of fact is the person that determines the credibility of the persons making this. The jury, 12 people on that jury, made a determination as to Mr. Ambrose's voluntariness.
And we have no findings from them.
No, we just have a verdict.
Was your client's statement voluntary or involuntary?
The order, I do not believe, gives us any insight.
I'm asking you now.
I haven't heard him. I did not hear Mr. Ambrose, but
Mr. Ambrose testified.
Pardon?
Mr. Ambrose testified. You're here defending his testimony at the hearing.
Yes, I will say.
From what he said, was Mr. Ambrose contesting the voluntariness of the statement during his appearance on this matter, the disciplinary matter?
I think that, with all due respect, I think that the statement was a product, as the ALJ found, that the statement was a product of very questionable tactics on behalf of the Hunterdon County Prosecutor's Office and the DOC. Four people were in the room. It was an ambush interrogation. All the factors that this court has reviewed on its Miranda decisions. He was given Miranda. He acknowledged he understood Miranda. He waived Miranda. That's what that order is about.
Respectfully, if a statement is coerced, does it get to go before the jury? Isn't that part of the pretrial challenge that takes place? Basic criminal law, coerced statements cannot be admitted.
I don't know whether that would be something that would be handled pre-trial.
Here, I'm sorry, your client, Mr. Ambrose, had filed a motion to suppress on the grounds that his statement was coerced. Then he withdraws that motion to suppress, and he specifically states on the record that his statement was given knowingly and voluntarily, and he did not object to its admission at trial.
Correct, Your Honor.
So isn't he bound by that in some way?
No, and then in the second page of that order, it specifically references the fact that this is within the context of determining, beyond a reasonable doubt, whether he was given Miranda, whether he understood Miranda, and whether he waived it.
Doesn't the order say, and the defendant having waived Miranda hearing?
Yes.
So he files a motion to suppress, and then he says, I actually want to withdraw my motion to suppress, yes, and this can be admitted at trial.
Yes, it was right. That's exactly right. But that doesn't end what happens in a trial, because the finder of fact is instructed. The jury is instructed that they have to make a determination as to the credibility.
You're correct as to that. However, assume in a different case, a defendant received Miranda warnings and then was physically or psychologically coerced in confessing thereafter. Are you telling us that that statement comes in? Miranda hearing is only about whether the Miranda warnings were provided?
That's what the Miranda hearing is about.
I don't believe that's the case. And I imagine that if you speak to the prosecutors who handled this, and indeed boilerplate first-year law school criminal law classes would suggest coerced confessions don't get admitted even if they are preceded by Miranda warnings, and they don't get in front of the jury. That was not what was argued here.
That's correct.
Until your client took the stand.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. But I will say that it would be unusual if the Department of Corrections either knew about that order and decided it was irrelevant, or simply overlooked it. It's on e-courts, right? It would. How could Mr. Ronco file a motion?
That's why my original question to you was, might it have affected the ALJ's determination about credibility if the ALJ knew this person is now trying to persuade me that they were coerced into providing the answers they did when they've already taken the opposite position?
Could it have affected the ALJ? Maybe. But the ALJ specifically indicates that she is basing this upon her in-person evaluation of the live testimony of Mr. Ambrose.
But she also watched the video, right? And that's why she came to all these conclusions that it was involuntary, because she said you know, did this wrong and they did that wrong.
Right. Everybody who has watched that video, every finder of fact who has watched that video has been, and considered it objectively, has been troubled by it. And I mean, there are four detectives in this room. There is the refusal to provide his labor rep. We talk about the techniques, the Palmer techniques
I'm sorry, the appellate division disagreed, right? Didn't the appellate division specifically hold that the investigators did not fabricate evidence and did not promise a lesser sentence if Mr. Ambrose spoke?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the ALJ had thus misapplied the criminal law.
Yes, but if he didn't fabricate the evidence, he came mighty close to it.
But again, your client, who was represented by counsel, by your firm at the time, withdrew his suppression motion and admitted that this was voluntary. That's the question that we're asking with regard to that stipulation and the impact that could have had.
The only thing I can say is that when you're trying a criminal case, there might be many reasons why you don't want to have a Miranda after initially filing for it. It's not unusual. But I just rest my position on the fact that the finder of fact, the jury, came to conclusions in this particular case. And perforce with that verdict, they had to have believed that his will, to a certain extent, was overborne by those circumstances.
I understand.
I understand the burden is different. I understand that this is not a judgment of the voluntariness of the statement in and of itself. But nevertheless, the verdict is there. It says, has to say something, means something. And, you know, that verdict is consistent with the findings below. It's not like the ALJ found something at variance or the Civil Service Commission found something at variance. At any rate, Your Honor.
Let's come back to the Attorney General's principal argument. And you've already acknowledged this was a serious incident and a highly concerning and extraordinarily concerning one at that. Can you respond to the argument that the CSC didn't sufficiently credit those considerations?
I don't think in its presentation to the Civil Service Commission, I don't think that the Department of Corrections proffered any way that these acts threatened the security of the of the prison. It wasn't, you know, they used the words, but they didn't define.
But how, I thought the CSC found that they did. The CSC specifically said that this touched at the heart of the safety and security of correctional facilities.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor, but they don't, and the Department of Corrections didn't indicate how. That's the point. They didn't consider.
But you didn't challenge the CSC's conclusion that it did, correct?
No, I don't. And they're bound and they're bound to consider that. There's no indication that they made a mistake, that their finding was unreasonable. And in light of that, there's no indication that their determination of the penalty is unreasonable or arbitrary and capricious. They did their job. And I think that they're entitled to that deference. Just one other factor with regard to the Civil Liberties Union amicus brief. Clearly, there is a need for reform at Edna Mann, and the state of New Jersey realizes that. That's why these prisoners were appointed to this board that the ACLU is representing. Their brief consists mainly of their opinion of this particular case, and it's important. It's an important impact, but I'm not so sure how informed these prisoners were about the status of this investigation, the status of the due process that Mr. Ambrose received, the same due process that those prisoners are entitled to, that any employee is entitled to. So I'm not so sure that their reactions just weren't just heartfelt statements with regard to, well, how can he get away with this? And we are held to account. He's got a badge. This must account for it. It's not an informed decision.
So take one of the principles that they're advancing in the context of the facts here, the extraordinary power imbalance between the corrections officer and the inmate. What impact does that have on the seriousness of this particular offense?
I think it has a tremendous impact. Corrections really exists based upon that principle and the problems associated with it. I understand why these rules and directives from the DOC have to be enforced, but there's also the responsibility to Mr. Ambrose that he be given the benefit of progressive discipline, that his actions be evaluated within the context of what actually happened here and not some theoretical threat. Your Honor, you have children who say they want to be police officers when they grow up. As far as I can see, nobody says they want to be corrections officers when they want to grow up. Everybody needs this stuff to be done, but it's like going to Ruth's Chris. Everybody wants the steak on the platter at Ruth's Chris. Nobody wants to go to the slaughterhouse and see the cows put down. This is Department of Corrections is, it's very difficult. Mr. Ambrose wants to continue in this job, which is very fraught and very dangerous. And I'm humbly asking the court to let him do that.
Other questions, anyone? Thank you, counsel. Mr. Malone.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. The commission largely viewed this appeal as a dispute between the Department of Corrections and Mr. Ambrose, and only filed a statement of brief in the appellate division below. But we did want to participate before this court because of the potential for broader impacts of this court's decision, and I thank your honors for the opportunity to do so. To comment briefly on the lens this court should view the matter through, it's well settled that the standard of review of commission penalty decisions is not whether this court would reach a different decision in the first instance, but whether the department whether the commission's penalty assessment is so shocking to this court's sense of fairness that it must be reversed. We submit that in a careful review of the record that was established before the commission below by the Department of Corrections and the facts and the charges that were proven in this case, the court should find that the commission's issuance of a 6-month suspension without pay in lieu of removal of Mr. Ambrose did not rise to that standard of shocking the court's sense of fairness and was entitled to affirmance. The thrust of the department's argument, as I understand it, has been that the commission did not adequately defer to its determination that Mr. Ambrose should be removed. But the standard set by this court over 40 years ago in Henry was that the commission reviews DOC's decisions de novo, giving weight to that appraisal of the conduct, but as a de novo review. Considered similar arguments in Henry to those that are raised here, the need for strict discipline in a correctional facility, the fear of eroding that, and the need to give weight to those considerations in the commission's penalty assessment. And to be clear, the commission does give DOC's appraisal significant weight as required by Henry and Bowdoin. But as recognized by this court in Henry, there should be evidence put before the commission as to the need for the sanctions sought by the department. The mere fact that DOC chose to remove the employee is not by itself enough that the commission has to rubber stamp that. Henry recognized that the commission may receive testimony or other evidence pertaining to safety, security, and discipline in prisons, and it can consider that evidence in deciding what sanction is warranted. And if you look at the record here, the department put on limited evidence as to the safety and security risks caused by Ambrose's conduct. There was testimony that it did go to the safety and security of the prison, but no real specific testimony beyond that as to what would happen if he was reinstated. There was testimony that it could be a removable offense, but I do not believe the record reflects that it must be a removable offense and why that is the case. And the commission recognized that testimony, and recognizing that the charges that were proven do go to safety and security at the prison, and in fact touch at the heart of it. But taking into account the principles of progressive discipline established by this court, the commission reasonably decided that Ambrose should be given a second chance, and that a 6-month suspension, which is a very serious sanction in itself, was sufficient for the conduct that was proven here. And the commission took into account that the more serious charge of sexual assault was not proven. It did recognize that passing a message could be a serious offense, and indeed was, that one passing of a message was very serious and warranting a serious sanction. But I think when you look at, as counsel for Mr. Ambrose noted, the nature of that message, it was, I love you and I'm mad at you. It wasn't something that itself jumped out as this must warrant removal for this specific message. And there was no testimony or evidence put forth by the Department of Corrections otherwise. And to touch briefly on the confession, the commission considered the order and reasonably found that did not change the analysis so as to warrant a remand. There was no real disputed fact changed by the order. The ALJ had already known and considered that the confession was played and admitted at the criminal trial, and that the jury was told it was up to them what weight they could give it. The ALJ had heard Mr. Ambrose testify before her. She had viewed the entire video of the confession, and she had viewed the videotape statement by the inmate J.O., and determined that that was not credible and that Mr. Ambrose's live testimony was credible. And that order did not change that analysis, and the commission's determination to not remand it was not arbitrary and capricious. And I know there's been questions on whether there were other decisions in which the commission has found a charge of undue influence to not warrant removal. I'm not aware of a specific decision.
Undue familiarity.
I apologize. I'm not aware of a specific decision, but I do note that one of the unpublished decisions relied upon by the department, Newsom, involved a case where the corrections officer had engaged in undue familiarity by passing messages from an inmate to his girlfriend. And the commission initially decided not to remove there, and it was only after specific evidence was put forth of the security risks there, including that that specific inmate was a flight risk, that the commission reconsidered its decision and removed that corrections officer. And I think that you can distinguish that case from the evidence that was put before the commission here, which again was only generalized testimony of safety and security impacts, which the commission did take into account, but decided that progressive discipline could be warranted given Mr. Ambrose's clean record up to that point.
Counsel, I didn't want to interrupt you in the beginning. What was the term that you used, that there was no inconsistency between the order and the proceedings, or was there a different term you used?
Frankly, Your Honor, I don't remember what term I used.
Is the order,
I think it was along those lines, and that during the OAL hearing.
Can you explain then how a finding of coercion, of involuntariness by the ALJ is not inconsistent with counsel's withdrawal of a challenge on that very ground?
What I meant by that, Your Honor, is that the ALJ was told that it was admitted at trial and played at trial. The ALJ already knew that fact in considering Ambrose's testimony at the OAL hearing. So, and I think whether or not she found it met the legal standard of improper interrogation, she clearly was troubled by what she saw, and that played into her analysis of what weight to give the confession versus what weight to give Mr. Ambrose's testimony that he had been felt pressured.
She threw it out on the basis of her interpretation of the law and what had happened in applying the law to the case, no?
She did, yes, she did cite that case law in her decision, but I do think it's a reasonable reading of her decision that she was troubled by the interrogation tactics, regardless of the legal standard. She found as a fact and concluded as a matter of law that it was improper tactics. And she credited his live testimony. I think it would have been different if he didn't testify live at that hearing, but he did testify. And I mean, by live, I mean via Zoom, but she heard him testify, heard his questioning, heard him repudiate the confession, and found that credible.
Whether the stip was timely presented or not, I find it hard to understand how it's consistent with what was done at the hearing itself. We can move beyond that, and you're welcome to comment.
And I will just comment on it, but the commission itself did consider the order. The commission considered the confession video, the testimony that Ambrose had given at the hearing. I believe it states in its decision that it reviewed that testimony and found that the order would not change the ALJ's credibility determinations based on its own review of the testimony.
Obviously, this case may have an impact on future cases. How do you view the commission's obligation under Henry and Bowden in a correction setting? You heard the discussion with the DOC's counsel, the attorney general. What is it that the commission considers itself obligated to do in a de novo review that's in a correction setting in reviewing a disciplinary charge or disciplinary determination?
The commission views its obligation consistent with that case law to give weight to the department's position, but I think the department has an obligation to explain why its position is what it is. It's not enough to just say safety and security. The department has an obligation to say what the specific impacts of this charge will be, of the specific conduct of the employee that it's being asked to review. And if it is, from the department's view, a single sanction charge, it's removal only, they need to explain that on the record, and that would be given significant weight by the commission. But I think Henry did require there to be evidence and testimony as to the risks at the prison from the conduct. And the department or the commission gives significant weight to that.
In Bowden, which was decided after Henry, the appellate division held that the CSE's expertise in employment matters is diminished in the quote sui generis context of correctional facilities, which can quote become tinderboxes if discipline is not maintained. And then they go on to say that the appraisal of the seriousness of the offense and the degree to which such offenses subvert discipline are matters peculiarly within the expertise of the corrections officials, and that appraisal should be given significant weight. You are not arguing that that case was wrongly decided, correct?
We are not. We have accepted that case for decades.
So then how does the commission's actions in this case fall within the rule set forth in Bowdoin?
I mean, I think we did give significant weight to their appraisal that there was a safety security risk that's reflected in the commission's decision that does go to the heart of safety and security at the prison. But I do think that there wasn't testimony that it could not be a six-month suspension that was removal and removal only. I think that there's a distinction between giving significant weight and deferring entirely to the Department of Corrections penalty decision, that once the charge is removed, they don't necessarily have to agree with the department that would be removal. They can still apply progressive discipline, giving weight to the department's appraisal.
Counsel, is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, thank you for the time.
Thank you. Mr. Levy, rebuttal? May I start with a question?
Yes, Your
Honor. We've heard thoughtful arguments by your colleagues on the other side that the problem here is that we've just heard generalized assertions about the risk to safety and security in the institution. And I wonder if you could respond and speak to what's been presented so far and what are the particular risks and threats in light of the facts of this case?
I'm happy to address that, Your Honor. And I think it's first important to start out by noting that the commission itself did not disagree with the DOC about the dire safety and security consequences. So it agreed, as Justice Weiner-Apter noted, that these offenses, both of them independently and especially combined as part of an overall pattern of failing to report and of undue familiarity concerning intimate sexual conduct, strikes at the heart of safety and security within the institution. And yes, we have certainly heard that there, the assertion that there was insufficient record evidence about the degree of safety and security consequences. Frankly, I'm not sure how much more record evidence beyond what was already presented here would matter when the commission itself recognizes those consequences, and as a matter of law, recognizes that those safety risks are often a necessary and sufficient condition for removal, even on first-time offenses. So I think it's the logic of the commission's findings and then its mitigation that's the problem here, rather than some dearth of evidence. But as to the what's in this record, just by way of example, to note some things in this record. So Lieutenant Washington, a 20-year DOC veteran who, at least at the time of the ALJ proceeding, was stationed at Endemand, testified a number of times to both examples of undue familiarity and the fact that they create safety and security risks and must be removed. So this appears at between 1T20 and 1T33 at numerous points. You know, by way of example, and as to Mr. McCann's suggestions at points that this case raises some questions about line drawing of undue familiarity. I think the record plainly supports the finding here that the CSC made that these acts did involve undue familiarity and that generally they are, in fact, removable. But there is evidence by Lieutenant Washington. There are, in addition, a number of policies, such as the over-familiarity policy, which appears at PA 70 to 73, which makes quite clear that no staff member shall establish or maintain a professional, non-professional, or personal relationship with an inmate. And in fact, if a corrections officer has a pre-existing relationship with an incarcerated person who then enters that institution, they have an obligation to report the existence of that relationship within 48 hours. These are very clear, very strict zero-tolerance policies. And the undue familiarity policy and the clear reporting mandates, it's important to recognize, also occur sort of as part of an overall disciplinary framework with a zero tolerance policy for sexual assault. So the failure to report a kiss from an incarcerated woman who, as the Chief Justice noted, is not legally able to consent really to any intimate physical contact with a corrections officer. The failure to report the kiss from that woman, for whom the officer had already performed verboten favors, raises serious doubt as to whether that same officer would faithfully comply with a zero tolerance policy towards sexual assault, which, as we all know, is paramount in an institution like Mann's. So as to all of the colloquies about the seriousness of this conduct and whether this conduct was or was not under familiarity or serious undue familiarity, none of that is in dispute here. The CSC found that these violations, that the sustained conduct here, the passing of the message combined with a failure to report a kiss, had serious safety consequences. And again, it recognized, as I noted, that generally and often that is enough to be removable. So all this court needs to say is that the one sentence explanation provided for mitigating the penalty to a 6-month suspension on the basis of this record with these very egregious substantiated acts was arbitrary and capricious. No one's disputing here that being a corrections officer is a hard job. I'm certainly not disputing that. It's precisely because it's such a hard job that the department, the women at Edna-Mann, and indeed the public as a whole, place the utmost trust in officers to comply with every single DOC policy. And the failure to explain why such a gross deviation from the standard of care expected of officers here warranted just 6 months is reversible. And just to briefly clear away some of the underbrush on our alternative position about reopening the record in the case of remand, I would just briefly note that, as some of the colloquies suggested, our reading of the stipulation is that Mr. Ambrose did affirmatively acknowledge the voluntariness of the video recorded confession. I think the words of that stipulation make it clear if there's any doubt. I think Mr. Ambrose's appellate division brief at page 17 also seems to acknowledge that. But once again, this court need not reach that issue of remand and reopening if it concludes, as it should, that the CSC's decision here was arbitrary and capricious and should be reversed outright.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel for the very fine arguments. We'll take